From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, we'll preview this week's WUWM news series on human trafficking in Milwaukee.
Later, how marketing practices are impacting tobacco use in communities of color.
What really shocks me is how deceptive and manipulative the tobacco industry still is.
A Milwaukee engineer helps a Guatemalan community recover from a devastating volcano.
And a Native American fiber arts exhibit in Cedarburg makes the case that visitors are seeing more than pretty objects.
We have said for a long time that our art is fine art. And you can look at our art through the lens of fine art criticism the same way you can take a look at the Dutch masters. There's technique, there's intention, there's beauty, there's meaning.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee has a reputation in law enforcement and among victim advocates as a hub for human trafficking. Starting tomorrow, that issue will be the topic of a five-part series on WUWM's Morning Edition.
WUWM's Mayan Silver is reporting the series, and she joins us in the studio to give us a preview. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Mitch.
So let's start with the basics. How do we define human trafficking?
So I spoke with Lieutenant Don Jones of the Milwaukee Police Department's Sensitive Crimes Division. She explained human trafficking in a nutshell.
Human trafficking is basically using force, fraud, or coercion to have somebody engage in some type of commercial sex acts or labor trafficking, though when it involves children, you don't need the force, fraud, or coercion.
Like Lieutenant Jones said, human trafficking can either be based on labor or commercial sex. We'll be focusing on sex trafficking for this series. And as you heard from Jones, under federal law, anyone making money off of or assisting a person who's under 18 to have sex for money is trafficking them. But there are also a few finer points. So making money off of or transporting an adult to have sex for money is also trafficking them. So it used to be called pandering, but now it's in the trafficking statute, though it's a lesser felony than using force, fraud, or coercion. And also, if someone buys sex from a minor, they can be charged with human trafficking.
So how is sex trafficking different than simply prostitution?
That is a good question. So if an adult is having sex for money and no one is making money off of them or helping them, then it's probably not trafficking. But Mitch, lines can be blurred, and over the past decade, there's been a shift in thinking on this. So we also talked to Attorney General Josh Call, and here's what he had to say.
There's been, I think, an increasing recognition among people in law enforcement that people who historically have been prosecuted for prostitution, for example, may very well and often are actually survivors of trafficking.
So as we said earlier, Milwaukee has kind of this reputation for this being a problem here. How widespread is it? What are some of the numbers around sex trafficking in Milwaukee?
Well, there's not a lot of local or statewide data. There was a study done of Milwaukee Police Department data from a four-year period. It was the beginning of 2013 to the end of 2016. They found 340 confirmed or suspected victims of human trafficking in Milwaukee. They were under the age of 25, so that doesn't include anyone older. But authorities and advocates do say that those numbers are a drop in the bucket with regards to what's going on in the city.
Why is that?
Well, first, there's the underground nature of the crime. A lot of interactions are happening on the internet, in hotels or motels. And in terms of coming forward, law enforcement and advocates say that victims may not trust the police. So that makes them, you know, that makes it more difficult for them to report through that avenue. Some may have a bond with their trafficker. Some may feel it's their fault and be ashamed to come forward. We were able to speak with a survivor who is using the pseudonym Michelle. She confirms that fear.
So a lot of survivors, myself included, for a long time hold a view of themselves that they were not victimized. We are conditioned to think that we made decisions that caused us to be exploited in the ways that we were exploited.
Since we're talking about victims here, who is most at risk to be trafficked?
The MPD data that we talked about earlier, those cases showed that on their radar were almost all women and girls. There's an organization called the Polaris Project. It's a national anti-trafficking organization. They analyzed 2017 data from the National Human Trafficking Hotline. They reported that they received information from over 10,000 survivors, and about 80% of those survivors were women. My understanding is that is involving labor trafficking and sex trafficking. But it's important to note that people from all genders and sexual orientations and identities can be trafficked. I spoke with Assistant District Attorney Erin Karshen, who broke it down.
So the average age for a girl, so if a girl were to run away, the national statistics are that within 24 hours she'll be approached by a trafficker, and the average age for entering or being coerced into trafficking is about 12 to 14. Those are the national statistics from GEMS in the Polaris Project. That's consistent with what we're seeing. Our victims range, frankly, all racial boundaries and a lot of different socioeconomic boundaries. So there's no one demographic that fits for a human trafficking victim.
So we heard from Erin Karshen. She did reference the pronoun she. I think it's also important to note, and she understands, that local advocates say that it can be all sorts of people. It can be boys and men as well. But local advocates say that turning to survival sex, exchanging sex for money, drugs, or gifts, is a problem for at-risk LGBTQ teens and homeless or runaway teens.
So what else will you cover in the series?
We'll hear more from Michelle, who's the survivor, about her experience about being trafficked. We'll talk to law enforcement about who the traffickers are and how they exert control over their victims. We'll talk to advocacy groups about what it takes to combat the problem. And we'll speak with legislators and other government officials about policy changes.
All right, we'll be listening. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Mayon Silver's series on human trafficking in Milwaukee begins tomorrow on Morning Edition.
We will take a quick break now, and then how marketing practices are impacting tobacco use in communities of color in Milwaukee and other large cities. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. According to the American Lung Association, tobacco use remains the nation's leading cause of preventable death and disease. In Wisconsin, the adult smoking rate is 16% compared to the national average of 14%. But smoking rates also vary in low-income communities that have majority residents of color compared to predominantly white communities. And experts believe that may have something to do with the way tobacco is marketed to specific neighborhoods.
Dr. Daniel Giovenco is a New York-based researcher who studies tobacco marketing practices. He sat down with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell during a recent trip to Milwaukee. He had visited several tobacco retailers in predominantly black neighborhoods here and says he saw similarities to what's common in New York.
E-cigarettes, Juuls, and all those vaping products were nowhere to be found in that community. What was more likely to be found in that community were 99-cent cigarillos. We know that those are sometimes smoked for the tobacco, but also they're used to smoke blunts with marijuana. Those products are incredibly cheap and come in more flavors than e-cigarettes do. You can get cigarillos in strawberry, grape. The list goes on and on. That is what is truly a candy store of flavors. It's these cigarillo products that are substantially cheaper than cigarettes. So I know in Milwaukee, a pack of cigarettes averaged about $8, $9. You can get two cigarillos for 99 cents. And that's exactly what we see in New York City and every major city across the country.
Does anything ever shock you as you do more research and visit different cities?
What really shocks me is how deceptive and manipulative the tobacco industry still is. So we've heard the stories from the 60s and 70s about how the industry would hide certain scientific data or use really deceptive tactics or downplay the risks of their products. And for some people, that seems like something from history, big tobacco, you know, being this evil source. But when you see how active big tobacco still is in communities, That's what surprises me, that this problem has not gone away at all. We were talking to a store owner yesterday who said that representatives from the tobacco industry come to his store every 2 weeks, and they make sure the shelving is displayed exactly how they want it. They adjust pricing. They adjust advertising. So some people don't think that the tobacco industry is really in their neighborhoods dictating all of this stuff, but they are, even in the smallest corner stores. So I think that's what surprises me most, how the tobacco industry is really on the ground in communities, making sure that they retain their consumer base.
And speaking of those retailers, how much say do they have in the display of tobacco products in their stores, if any?
I really empathize with the retailers because we talked to a few who were wonderful people and knew very well that tobacco is bad for health, and they would say, if we didn't have to sell this, we wouldn't. We know that it's a dangerous product, but if we take it off of our shelves, people will go to the store down the street to start buying not just tobacco, but to buy their food products.
So they're losing business.
So they're potentially losing business if they were to voluntarily remove tobacco from their shelves or cut ties with the industry. So I empathize with them because this is their livelihood and this is their consumer base. But it was refreshing to see that these store owners do care about the health of their communities, and they felt at odds with some of the products they were selling and also feeling that connection to their community. So it's a challenge, and I think that's why retail-focused tobacco policies have been the most difficult ones to implement. You know, it's easy to create an educational campaign and even to raise taxes on certain products, but with policies that affect store owners and community members, you have pushback from store owners, you have pushback from the industry, you have pushback from customers. So it's really difficult to pass these policies, but I think that these are the policies that could have the greatest impact. Tobacco is a consumer product that people buy in stores, and if you intervene in the stores, you have the potential to help a lot of people quit, reduce tobacco use, reduce disparities. So I think that we need to very forcefully continue to implement policies at the point of sale.
Speaking of policies, in your presentation, you talked about a policy in New York that banned all tobacco products in pharmacies. Do you think that could work in Milwaukee?
That's a good question. So tobacco-free pharmacy laws are increasing in popularity everywhere. A lot of cities are starting to adopt them, and I think it makes total sense. Pharmacies are supposed to be centers of health and wellness, and many of them are selling the deadliest product that exists. So selling these products just doesn't align with what the mission of pharmacies are. So I fully support tobacco-free pharmacy laws, but what we have to pay attention to is what neighborhoods are more likely to benefit from those laws. In New York City, we did a study and we found that most of the pharmacies that were selling tobacco are in largely white neighborhoods, more affluent neighborhoods. So the impact of that ban was more likely to benefit these wealthier neighborhoods. Some of the low-income neighborhoods that we studied in New York City, people don't buy their tobacco from pharmacies and drugstores. They buy it from their bodega or from the local corner store. So this policy wasn't effective in reducing disparities, even though it was a smart policy to pass. So I think in Milwaukee, it would be something really great to pursue, but you also have to make sure that the results of or the impact of that policy has an equitable effect across neighborhoods.
Explain what you mean by equity versus equality as it pertains to this situation.
So the difference between an equal policy and an equitable policy is that an equal policy is applied the same to everyone, but it may not actually achieve equality in the long term. So I use the example of kids trying to look over a fence to watch a baseball game. Let's say one of the kids is already standing on a box and is kind of closer to the top of that fence than the other two kids. In other words, that kid has a head start. An equal policy, let's say you give each kid one box to stand on. Well, the kid that already had a box now has two boxes. So he is higher and can see over the fence where the other two still can't. So if you give the same resources to everyone, it's equal, yes, but you may advantage those who are already at an advantage to begin with. whereas an equitable policy is, it uses a much more tailored approach to make sure that all of the kids can see above the fence at the end of the day. And that may require giving more boxes to the kids that had zero boxes to begin with, and less boxes to the kid who already was at an advantage.
So let's talk about supply and demand, because I've seen arguments on social media saying things like, you can't be mad at tobacco companies for setting up shop in these neighborhoods if the numbers say people in these areas are smoking the most. But are people in low-income communities really smoking more than people in communities that are considered more affluent?
That's a great question. And it's true that in communities where there are more smokers, there may be more retailers and more advertising to appeal to those people who are current users. But we can't just think about people who are currently using tobacco products, because there's a lot of other groups that are entering those stores. There are youth who are not smoking yet, who have never tried tobacco, that are now in an environment where tobacco is everywhere and it's heavily promoted. And youth living in those neighborhoods, research shows that they're more likely to start smoking when they're surrounded by that, those very normative behaviors. So yes, to some extent, the retail environment reflects use patterns in the community, but that also doesn't make it okay if it encourages use among people who have not started yet. And one more thing to add about that point. There are a lot of smokers, for example, who really want to quit. And so they are current users, and they have products advertised and available to them. But being in an environment where marketing is extremely heavy and where there's a tobacco retailer on every corner, it makes those individuals have a harder time quitting, too. So I think we do need to use retail-based approaches to prevent use, as well as to help current users quit.
On that same topic of who smokes more, research shows Black people smoke later in life and less than white smokers, but die in higher numbers. What's the reason for that? Do we know?
It is a very complicated answer. Menthol might have a lot to do with it. Black smokers smoke menthol cigarettes more than any other group of smokers. I don't know the exact number, but I think about 80% of Black smokers smoke menthol. And we know that menthol makes it harder to quit. Some researchers believe that menthol allows you to inhale much more deeply because of the cooling effect. Yeah. So it's possible that some of the toxins and carcinogens are embedded deeper into the lungs. So that could have something to do with it. But then there's a lot of other layers. So access to care could be part of the problem too. There's a lot of layers, and some of it might be later access to treatment, mm-hmm. if you do have a cancer diagnosis. But I think it really highlights a lot of the structural inequalities that exist. Mm-hmm. It's not just about health behaviors. It's related to these societal structures, like access to services, like resources, like medical care. Another reason why it's a complicated issue to address, because you really need to use many different approaches and not just one.
So in your opinion, what can media do better in their coverage on tobacco use?
I think the media needs to acknowledge the risk differences between these tobacco products. So, for example, e-cigarettes uses on the rise among youth, which is a problem. We've seen extremely high rates of youth use. But cigarettes are a far more deadly, far more dangerous product. And they're being used by historically vulnerable populations, those with low income, those in poverty, those with mental health issues, veterans, LGBT Americans. The list goes on and on. Smoking rates are extremely high among these groups, and it's causing unnecessary morbidity and mortality. So I think the media should be cautious. On the one hand, you do want to report issues that are on the rise and that are new and novel, but you also can't lose sight of the products that are killing the most amount of people and that are responsible for preventable death and disease among at-risk groups. And I worry that because of all of the media hype around e-cigarettes, we're diverting a lot of our attention away from combustible products. So cities, states, local governments are all starting to act very quickly to prevent e-cigarette use and passing these really progressive policies, while at the same time allowing menthol cigarettes to continue to be sold, allowing flavored cigars to continue to be sold, not addressing the fact that cigars can be sold for 99 cents. So you can work on preventing e-cigarette use while also focusing or doubling down on your efforts to prevent use of all tobacco products.
Dr. Daniel Giovanco is an assistant professor at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. He talked with WUWM's Taryn Powell about the importance of addressing tobacco use and marketing in low-income communities.
We'll take another break, and then a Milwaukee engineer talks about the challenges of restoring mobility to a Guatemalan community following a volcanic eruption. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Parts of the Midwest are still reeling from spring flooding caused by a winter's worth of snow melting in a very short period of time. The floods have caused hundreds of millions of dollars in property damage, even in places that have planned for such an occurrence.
There is less a small community in Guatemala can do to plan for the devastation caused by a volcanic eruption, and that's where the work of people like Mike Paddock comes in. Paddock is a Milwaukee area engineer and also a volunteer with the international organization Engineers Without Borders. We invited him to join us to talk about the role he played in helping that community recover. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Give us some background on what happened in Guatemala that took you there this most recent time.
Yeah. So in June 3rd of last year, the volcano Fuego had a major eruption. And what does a major eruption look like down in Guatemala? It's a six-mile cloud of debris that gets spewed up into the air. And when that debris comes down, because gravity forces it down, it causes what we call pyroclastic flows. So that's basically landslides of all that debris rushing down the mountain several hundred miles per hour. And that's the stuff that causes all the damage, because it's not just dust. It's big rocks like the size of a table. But it's also super hot, so if you happen to be touching it, it would burn you. And so we lost about 500 lives during that event.
Well, and I think a lot of us, when we think about volcanoes, we have this image of the Hawaiian eruptions, the molten lava, you know, pouring down a hillside. But that is not what this looks like, but the destruction is similar.
Yeah, so, you know, every volcano, there's different types of volcanoes. This particular one is a little bit different than the ones that we would see in Hawaii. They call this a stratovolcano, which is the most common, and this would be the type that has a lot of this ash and debris that goes up and then has this big kind of debris flow that comes down.
And as is often the case, if I'm not wrong, the volcano exists in an area of some seismic activity, so there have been earthquakes in the same region, right?
Yeah, for sure. So Guatemala is kind of a high-risk region just to start out with. So it's at the nexus of three continental plates. So we've got the Pacific plate that's to the west. To the north, we have the North American plate. And to the south, we have the Caribbean plate. So because of that, there's a lot of earthquakes as well as a lot of volcanoes in the region.
Give us maybe paint a picture of what the landscape in this area looks like. This is obviously far south of where we are in Milwaukee. Are we talking about a pretty tropical climate?
Yeah, so Guatemala's got a varied climate across it. So there's an altiplano that is kind of in the northern region, which is mountainous and actually pretty comfortable from a temperature standpoint. And then that goes all the way down to like a jungle climate as you get closer to the coast. And where this particular location is that it's pretty close to the coast. So it's pretty hot, a lot of banana trees and like jungle type activities. We actually were working on four different sites, and a couple of the sites were right in the heart of sugarcane country, so there was a lot of sugarcane plantations. But it's also as we got a little bit more elevation, a lot of coffee. So there's a lot of coffee plantations and trees and things like that. But certainly a lot warmer and stickier, I'll say, than it was here in Wisconsin.
Well, so you mentioned the loss of life, which was extensive. What about the as an engineer, I mean, let's talk about the kinds of structural destruction this caused.
Yeah, so that flow did a lot of damage to the infrastructure. Certainly homes, as well as a lot of the other infrastructure like water. So, for example, like water lines, which typically are being serviced by springs in this area, be taken out. So all of a sudden, even the hospitals that are trying to respond to this type of event don't have potable water, which was a major concern. But the primary thing that I was working on was the with Engineers Without Borders was the replacement of four bridges. And the reason that they were so important is they're really critical evacuation routes. So if the volcano erupts again, now the people wouldn't be trapped and they would be able to evacuate from those locations. So that was the mission.
How does this play into to the work that you already do as an engineer?
Well, it's it was very interesting. So my career, 25 years working with CH2M, all in here in Milwaukee. A lot of it was the freeway work, was had the privilege of leading the market interchange design. And so for engineers, it's all about kind of weighing risk. And for me, it was really amazing at this site because when I walked there for the very first time last July, it was like literally being there the day after God created the heavens and the earth. There was destruction everywhere.
You walked there. How it must? It can't be easy to get to a place like this, especially after a volcano.
Right. So you have to make your way there with four-wheel drive vehicles and then make a little bit of a trek by foot to be able to get to the site to see what is the potential solutions for something like this, right? And you want to make sure that it's an appropriate response. And the first engineering reaction would be is, well, we got to let things settle down, right? You know, we need to know is more material going to come down from the volcano? Is there going to be the river is going to take it all away? So this there's just too many unknowns. I can't do this. And then, of course, then you realize that these people are trapped. And so you've got to come up with some sort of solution. So that was the challenge on this particular site.
Do you work on both a short-term and a long-term solution, or is this something that you really only have, you know, one bite at the apple here? You've got to do something that will both serve the people who are currently trapped but also last beyond, you know, presumably the next time some kind of seismic activity happens.
Yeah. So, Mitch, this is my seventh disaster response that I've done with Engineers Without Borders around the globe. And usually we have an interim solution, so it'd be immediately restoring water lines or maybe temporary shelters or temporary bridges, and then there's a longer-term solution. In this particular case with these bridges, I believe that there probably won't be long-term vehicle bridges or bigger solutions put in there. So we knew that this kind of needed to cover both bases, immediate evacuation route as well as provide access to healthcare, education, and markets.
So how do you do it? How do you get the material in place that you need to be able to construct a bridge in honestly, a place that's so difficult to get to?
Yeah, that's a challenge for us. Fortunately, there was a road that was able to be put in, so we were able to get things like cement delivered and those kinds of things. But the real challenge is actually the construction. So the construction on these projects is done with volunteer labor. So we had 8 different communities of the 15,000 people there, and they would rotate and provide 100 laborers on the project every day. It was my job to try to figure out how to keep them all busy effectively, and that's how the actual work was done. And, of course, the workers have varying degrees of skill. Some of them were builders, and some of them were farmers. So we needed to be able to make sure that we were maximizing their skill base, too.
How many engineers were on the project?
There was myself and 2 Guatemalan engineers that were on the project.
Would I assume that you speak Spanish?
Well, I do my best. I actually had to do a live TV interview in Spanish, which caused me to soil myself, but I did my best.
Well, and so talk about before and after. What's in place there now?
Yeah. So before the issue was is people weren't going to be able to get across, and especially during the rains. So timing is everything when it comes to disaster response. So it's kind of interesting when we do development work, it's all about sustainable solutions. But when it comes to disaster response, I kind of have to take my hard hat and turn it around and realize that it's all about speed because we're trying to help people before we have people tip over, if you will. So in this particular case, we wanted to get these bridges in place before the rains came, which should start in a couple of weeks. So we had to build these 4 bridges in 6 months. So that was a really an aggressive time frame. So the people were worried, right? I mean, when we got there at all these sites, people are concerned because they know that they're going to be trapped, especially when the rains start to come. And so they're really concerned. And, of course, we were able to get these bridges put in place, get them across a span, and really took a lot of that pressure off of them. You know, one of the things that I thought was amazing is that it was more than the bridge, because it was something positive, finally, in their lives that they could work on together that was tangible and they could see, right? And so that really helped, I think, mend some of the social fabric that had been stretched and torn.
This is the point that the impact of this bridge construction goes beyond the physical here.
Exactly, exactly. So if you can imagine, we've got 8 different communities, right? And there's 2 different municipalities, like local governments, counties, if you will, and the Army Corps of Engineers are involved. And it's been my experience when it comes to disasters that it really stretches that social fabric, right? And so now all of a sudden you lose faith in your God, you lose faith in your government, in your neighbors, and maybe even the rest of your family members. So all of these entities are looking at each other, knowing that they have to depend on each other, but at the same time they're doubting if they're really going to be able to succeed. And so through the bridge project, it started out with a lot of people with a lot of concerns, and then over the months we saw that changed. And people got comfortable working with each other again, and relationships were pulled back together, and it really started to mend that social fabric, which maybe was the biggest gift that happened with this project.
You're building literal and metaphorical bridges here.
Exactly, exactly.
Who called you down there? Who gets involved to say, hey, we need a team from Engineers Without Borders to play a role in this?
Yeah, so Engineers Without Borders gets their request from several different places. Much of the time, when I did the response to Maria, that was a request that we got from the United Nations. So United Nations sometimes calls us. When I did my response over in Ethiopia, that was United Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance from USAID. In this particular case, it was interesting because the call had come from Rotary International. And so the Rotarians were actually part of this response. And our own club here in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Rotary Club, was part of the donations that helped pay for the materials for the project. And I'm also a Rotarian as well as a member of EWB.
So when you're involved in this and you've built 4 bridges as the engineer who's kind of overseeing this work, do you have to be confident enough in what's been constructed to be willing to be the first person across that bridge once it's standing?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the people are putting a lot of faith in you. And I'll share with you one story, Mitch, that was from a different project. That it was for the volcano, and we were building the bridge wide enough so that we could get vehicles across, right? And these bridges that we build are made out of cable. It's actually repurposed cable from the port. So we recycle that cable that they use to lift all the containers and then give it a retirement home, if you will, to be used on a bridge. So we have to inspect it and all those kinds of good things to make sure it's safe, but it's a great solution for them. Well, these people had never seen a bridge like this before. And so they kept asking me, you know, how many bulls could go on the bridge and how many motorcycles can cross on the bridge and how many cars and all of those kinds of things. But when the day came for the first vehicle to go across and we called the taxi to come over and be the first vehicle to take some of the leaders across, the taxi driver's like, no way, Jose, man, I'm not going across. And I realized at that point that I needed to drive the taxi across the first time. And of course, after the first one went, now there's taxis going across it all the time. But yeah, you have to have that kind of confidence to be able to stick your neck out a little bit.
You said the rains are likely to start up here in mm-hmm. the next few weeks as mm-hmm. we're having this conversation. That has to be kind of where the rubber meets the road for you, to keep track of how well this has worked.
Exactly. You know, and each site has its own set of risks that we had. And so that'll be kind of the test. The real thing is, as we have talked a lot with the volcanologists to try to figure out what that risk profile looks like, right? And one of the big things is if we get hit with a major event like a hurricane, which does happen in Guatemala as well, then that could really raise that risk profile. And the thing that I guess for me that got me more comfortable with what we were doing there, because how do you build a bridge that's going to be volcano-proof? Really not possible. What I realized that the purpose of this bridge was not to be a long-term solution for access to healthcare and markets. What it was is to provide an evacuation route for those 15,000 people. So if there's another eruption and those 15,000 people get across there into safety and then the bridge gets destroyed, I've done my job.
Well, and I wonder if one of the long-term impacts of this is just to have a plan for the next time a bridge has to be constructed after the next volcano hits and the people have gotten out safely. There's a plan in place that this is how you can rebuild it.
That's true. And of course, one of the big wild cards that we have is that when so much material gets moved down from the mountain, sometimes the rivers move. So my bridge might be there, but it might not be over the river anymore. So that causes another separate set of challenges. So there is always those kinds of risks, but at the same time, when you've got that many people that are trapped, you've got to come up with an immediate solution.
So it's spring in Milwaukee. Are you on call for the next disaster now? How often do you go out on projects like this?
Well, it's been quite a bit of a stretch here for me. 2 years ago was over in Afar, Ethiopia, on a drought. Last year was spending most of my time in the Caribbean, responding to Maria. And then now it's been since July working on the volcano. So I'm looking forward to spending a little bit of time getting caught up with my wife, rediscovering her a bit.
She's pleased about that.
She hasn't thrown me out. And then I'm hoping this later this month be able to get up north and spend a little time making maple syrup with my 80-year-old dad.
That sounds great. Well, Mike Paddock, thank you so much. Thanks for your work and for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mike Paddock is a Milwaukee area engineer and a volunteer with the international organization Engineers Without Borders. You can see photos of the work that he did in Guatemala at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then we'll chat with a member of the Oneida Nation, the curator of an exhibit of Native American fiber art, currently on view at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. Lake Effect continues on WUWM right after this. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Native American art has not often been characterized as such by the non-Native world. From intricately beaded clothing to ceramics to jewelry, the artworks that Native peoples here created and continue to create often find themselves in the craft or perhaps the folk art areas of museum exhibitions.
Karen Ann Hoffman says, not so fast. Hoffman is Oneida and a renowned Iroquois-raised bead worker who was raised in Milwaukee and now lives and works in Stevens Point. She curated the Native Fiber exhibit currently on view at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. The show features contemporary work by more than 30 Native artists representing 20 tribal nations from around the Great Lakes.
As you'll hear as I tour the exhibit with her, Hoffman makes the case that what we're viewing in Cedarburg is as culturally and artistically significant as any Dutch master painting, even if she started her own art practice by making a pair of simple beaded moccasins.
I really wasn't doing culturally connected Iroquois raised beadwork until the 1990s when Samuel Thomas and his mother, Lorna Hill, came from Niagara Falls, Ontario, into Wisconsin and led the first series of Iroquois raised beadwork workshops.
So what makes that a particular type of beadwork? What are the specifics for Iroquois beadwork versus anyone else?
It's very interesting to me that the same simple materials, steel needle, little bit of cotton thread, a glass bead, can be used to express really distinctive cultural styles. So Iroquois raised beadwork is work that's done only by members of the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederacy. There are six nations. It's a cultural hallmark for us. The six nations of the Iroquois Confederacy are, from east to west, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, the Senecas, and later the Tuscaroras came up out of the Carolinas and joined us.
And so the Oneidas are here, is that right?
About 1820, we made our first forced migration out of the homelands in New York State to the state of Wisconsin. I would say there was a little issue around the Erie Canal. That issue was that we lived there, and so the powers that be needed to remove us from our homeland to complete the Erie Canal and get that kind of commerce effective. So in the 1820s, the first wave of Oneidas left our homelands in New York, and we were moved westward into Wisconsin, sometimes even further on into Kansas. But yes, that's how Iroquois raised beadwork comes to be here in Wisconsin.
Take me to an example that really shows that. It's all over here, but...
well, come with me.
Okay.
And let me show you this. What we're looking at is a small footstool. This footstool is embroidered, embellished with clear glass beads. Those beads are piled up in a way that makes them into Iroquois raised beadwork. So a lot of Indian nations use beads. A lot of woodland nations use beads on velvet. We Iroquois are the only people who pile our beads in this extravagant, mounded, beautifully dimensional way. And so the subject that I beaded onto this footstool is an example of native art that's been on Wisconsin's landscape for no one knows how long. This is an image of an effigy mound, the Mound Man. He lives outside of Baraboo, Wisconsin. He was constructed, no one knows how long ago, but probably 1,000 years or more. So there has been native art on our landscape for a very long time. I wanted to honor the original artists with my contemporary take on their old cultural thoughts.
It is beautiful, and I'm standing here. The light is hitting the Mound Man's glass beads that are stacked and piled. I mean, when you bend down to look across it, you can see it's like 3/8 of an inch thick.
Right, that dimensional nature is really the hallmark of Iroquois raised beadwork. That's why we use that word raised. But, you know, a lot of people want to know, what's the predecessor for raised beadwork? People always ask, where did the Indians get the beads? You know, because there was a time when beads, glass beads, were not available to us. And so prior to that, our material arts used stone. We used shell. We used not so much porcupine quills where we live, because porcupines didn't really live there in that abundance. But what we did have were moose. And so we used moose hair in a dimensional way that's a predecessor of raised beadwork.
Is there any kind of spiritual content to this in doing it or in the result of it?
My old people told me that your religion, your spirituality, is not something separate from who you are. It's not something that you do on a Sunday morning or while you're sitting at a beading table. Our religion, they told me, is expressed in the way you walk through this world, so that everything you do is a result of that. I think that's particularly true for me when I bead. I feel very connected to what my old people, Christian and non-Christian, traditional people, have explained to me about the right way to walk through the world. And so it's important to me that the subjects that I bead are deeply connected to our cultural past. This particular piece of Iroquois raised beadwork is Bernard. It's a buzzard bag. It's a very old Iroquois story that tells us, on the surface of it, how it is that the birds got their clothes. But on a deeper level, it's a story about honesty, commitment, making a promise, and keeping your commitments no matter what the personal cost. Because the important thing for our lives is to live in such a way that the community prospers more than the individual. And so those are the cultural stories that are important to me to bead into my work. Stories of commitment, stories of peace, stories of promise, stories of honor.
And this is spectacular. What a beautiful, beautiful piece we have. Is that leather off the end there, or is that bone?
These are really simple materials. The body of the bag is an amazing red velvet. It's embellished with Czechoslovakian glass beads in black, striped gray and white. Also, I was gifted with some 14-karat gold beads by my teacher, Samuel Thomas, and so I incorporated those 14-karat gold beads into this. but it's embellished, the bag itself is embellished with the toes of deer.
Oh, wow.
Some of my old people say that that's the sound that was heard when the world was created. The deer plays a very important part in this story, and so the jangles are there not just for the heck of it, but to remind us of how the deer made a personal sacrifice so that Buzzard could live up to his commitment to the rest of the bird community. Yeah, yes. This stuff is amazing. I love Iroquois raised beadwork and what it has to teach us. I am so grateful to my teacher, Samuel Thomas, and his mom, the late Lorna Hill. I cannot even begin to describe.
Well, we have other kinds of fiber mm-hmm. and materials here as well. How many nations are represented in this exhibit?
I'm going to say off the top of my head that there are about 20 different Native nations and probably 30 or more artists. It's difficult to give the exact number of artists because some of the work is the cooperative effort of a guild. And so many artists have contributed to singular pieces. We have about 60 pieces in the exhibit.
And are all of the nations represented from Wisconsin, or are they from a broader perspective?
We're very fortunate in this exhibit to drain great art from the entire Great Lakes watershed. There's work here that comes from the shores of Lake Superior. There's work that comes from Indiana. There's work that comes from the mouth of the Green Bay. There's work that comes out of Montreal. There's work that comes out of New York. This work has drained to us from all over the Eastern Woodlands.
How long did it take you to put it all together?
I concocted this idea about a year and a half ago. I approached the museum about this idea, and they were so supportive. It was just crazy wonderful. Once I knew I had the museum's support, I reached out to my network of artist friends. About 3/4 or more of the art that you see in this exhibit was created specifically for this exhibit. The artists, who are internationally known, were excited about the opportunity to create new art for a dedicated fiber art show.
You know, there's something about all of the fiber arts, whether it's beading, whether it's quilting, whether it's crocheting and knitting and lace making and all of those kinds of things, there's something so personal about it. It's both practical and beautiful and artistic. It kind of wraps all of those things together. Wrap, I didn't mean that as a pun for fiber, but you know, it's like all of those things get combined in all of these pieces.
And so this fusion that you're describing, this fusion of art, ecology, science, beauty, statements, commitments, that fusion is the religion that goes through all of these pieces. And it is incredible to me, the variety that we have on exhibit here. Yes, there's fabric. Yes, there's quilting. Yes, there's beading. But there's also birch bark. There's also newspaper. There's also weaving. There's also leather. There's fur. There's black ash basketry. There's corn husk art. Anything you can think of that comes from our natural world has been processed by the hands of an artist into a statement about our world here today.
Do you think we're having a moment right now where Native art is finally coming into its own, into the greater world, where non-Native people can appreciate it and understand it as art, as well as a comment on ecology and faith and all of those things?
It may be a new moment for some of our audiences. It's an old moment for some of us artists. But what I would say is this. What I see shifting is the relationship between venues and Native artists. There is not now and never has been a shortage of talent in the Native artists. There has not been a shortage of beautiful quality venues, especially in Wisconsin, for a very long time. But what there has not been, in my opinion, is a bridge between the two. That bridge building that we're involved in is, to me, what's new and what's exciting. And the benefit of that bridge for our native artists is that it gives us new and exciting venues to explore. But for the audiences who are not familiar with us, the benefit is to see these materials in this whole new way. We have said for a long time that our art is fine art. And you can look at our art through the lens of fine art criticism the same way you can take a look at the Dutch masters. There's technique, there's intention, there's beauty, there's meaning. But now you get to see it from a whole new set of artists with a whole new set of materials. I think that's exciting.
I do too. And I think one of the things you've probably, as a group of artists, suffered from is the genre, you know, of like, oh, this is folk art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so with the folk in front of it, it mm-hmm. somehow lessens it. It takes mm-hmm. it away from seeing it simply as art. And I think this is fantastic that we're showcasing the materials, the artists, the kinds of work that's being done as not somehow less than, which folk art somehow, I think a lot of people...
Undeservedly.
Yes. I think a lot of people think folk art and they think, oh, it's just, you know, anyone can do this. And no, this is years. This gentleman right here, Pat Krause, that we're standing in front of his gorgeous piece, you know, more than 30 years of his own practice. And the
generations prior to him.
Right.
It's true. It's true.
Right.
It's true what you say about folk arts being less well respected than quote unquote fine arts. I personally don't believe it's true, but I understand that that is the perception. And so you're right, Native art for far too long has suffered from the perception that it was a trinket, that it's less than, that it does not have the same value, monetary or artistic value. That's the change that these bridge building exhibits can affect. Now, fine art in a fine art venue done by a native hand gets the same amount of understanding, respect, and artistic criticism as any other kind of fine art. And that's what we want. We want to be in all of those arenas. We deserve to be in all of those arenas. And thanks to this museum, we are here.
Karen Ann Hoffman is a nationally renowned Iroquois-raised bead worker. She lives and works in Stevens Point and is the curator of the Native Fiber exhibit currently on view at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg. There's more information and some photos at WUWM.com. That's all for Monday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.